I like to do that before I talk because it helps me get in a better perspective. You know, I used to use that moment of silence to go, I hope they like me, hope they like me, hope they like me, hope they like me. Now what I use it for is hope I'm honest, hope I'm honest, hope I'm honest, hope I'm honest. But, you know, it's important to me. You know, what is Narcotics Anonymous about? Well, to me, this is part of what Narcotics Anonymous is about, standing up and letting you know who I am, letting you know that, you know, that I'm a real person, that I'm an addict, letting you into my life, letting you see my assets and my defects, letting you see my successes and my failures. And it's a big part of NA to me for sharing with each other, for letting each other in, for taking that risk, you know, to let you know who I am, and for me to find out who you are. That's a big part of what this thing's about. My story isn't real glamorous. I didn't do a lot of stuff out there. I started using when I was a kid by prescriptions before I knew there was any such thing as drugs. These were just prescriptions. They were pills that the doctor gave me. And by the time I was 10 years old, I was taking, you know, speed for my weight control. I was taking sleeping pills because the speed for the weight control kept me awake. And I was taking tranquilizers because the speed for the weight control made me nervous. And I cheated on all of them. And the medicine cabinet was fair game, and I put Percodan on top of that and other things, all kinds of stuff. And I wasn't using any drugs. At least I didn't think so. I mean, I'd read about drug addicts. You know, I heard about drug addicts. You heard about drug addicts, didn't you, growing up? What horrible people they were. I mean, really, drug addicts. You know, I remember going to my first meeting scared to death because I'd heard about drug addicts. I'd read the books, and I saw Reefer Madness, and, you know. Naked Lunch, I read, and, you know, all those things. And, you know, I was terrified of you because I never did a lot of those things that I hear people, you know, advertise as being what drug addicts are about, particularly back in the 50s and the 60s. I got into high school. I found out there were other drugs. I liked those, too. I probably used my share and a couple other people's share. And that's what I did. I basically missed my adolescence, you know. My time out there was, you know, I graduated from high school in February of 1965 in California. And I was using at that time, I was captain of the football team, president of the choir, and the connection. And you had to wait till after football practice to cop. You know, and that's what I did. I don't remember much of the 60s. Somebody said one time that if you remember the 60s, you probably didn't participate. You know, and it's kind of the way it was. You know, Monterey Pop. I was at Monterey Pop Festival. I wasn't Woodstock. I was in California. I was at Monterey. Great music, Jimi Hendrix. All, I don't remember a thing. Too loaded. You know, I was out there and I'd taken, you know, a few hits of a few different things, and I was wandering around going, I wonder where my car is. You know, that's kind of what it was like. Or the guy's landing on the moon, a giant step for mankind, and I'm going, and I missed it and had to watch the reruns. You know, that's what I did. That's how glamorous my using was. You know, I never did anything. I just used drugs every day for 15 years, from the time I was 7 years old to the time I was 23, give or take a little. I had no time off for bad behavior. I've never been arrested. I've never been hospitalized. I've never been in treatment. There wasn't any treatment. I never did an armed robbery. I never snatched a purse. I never, what else didn't? I didn't do a lot of things. Never had quarter-sized holes drilled in my head. I've never been in the psych wards. I just used every day. And it kicked my ass. I'm liable to say a couple of offensive things here because I say offensive things occasionally, and I apologize for those in advance, but there's some things that I can only express that way because they are vulgar to me. I'll try not to do that too much. But I used all I could use. And for a while it seemed like it was great. And I'd found the answers. This is what I'd been looking for. It was wonderful. It gave me, you know, a way to not feel who I was. It gave me a way not to be lonely. It gave me a way to fit in. It gave me a way to be a real person that I never felt unless I was high. And the last year of my using brought me to Narcotics Anonymous. That's what it boils down to. Some things started happening, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I started losing family and friends. My wife and I, before we were married, we gave a child up for adoption, and I hated myself. You know, the guilt and the shame. And the realization that I probably wouldn't be around to help raise that child, and I couldn't promise to be there. Because going the way I was going, I'd probably be dead within 6 months. And we finally got married not too long after that. And Lois and I celebrated our 23rd wedding anniversary. Last Sunday, we have a relationship that survived recovery. And I'll talk briefly about relationships. We all like to talk. I was asked to do a relationship workshop, about a month ago, in Florida. It's the first time I've ever been asked to do a relationships workshop. They don't ask people who have long-term marriages to do relationship workshops, because just like my using, you know, we've just been together for 23 years, and, you know, there have been good times and bad times, and, you know, we're monogamous, and we like each other, and, you know, it's working. It's a working marriage, and, you know, it's not like there's a big war story about that either. Most of us don't do relationships well. I'm not a believer in no relationships in the first year. I don't know what's magic about the 366th day. I was just as incapable of having a successful relation at 366 as I was at 364. You know, there was nothing magic about that time. What happened was buying me a little time allowed me to do an inventory. And we had to put our marriage on hold for a couple of years because we didn't know if we were going to make it. And every once in a while, about once or twice a year, we go, well, I think we'll try this for another month. Maybe it'll work out. You know, it's one of those, it's kind of like I heard someone say earlier today, something that I like, you know. I've been clean now 22 years, and, you know, I still don't know if NA works. But what the hell, it's been a good 22 years, you know. So far, so good. I'll let you know. I'll keep you posted. You know, if I find something better, I'll let you know. So far, I have found nothing better, and this is still a hell of a lot better than it was using. If this wasn't better than using, I wouldn't be here. If the feelings I got weren't higher than I have ever been on drugs, I wouldn't be here. If the lows weren't that much higher, I wouldn't be here. If my life wasn't that much better, I wouldn't be here, even with all the ups and downs and the trials and tribulations and all that stuff. My grandmother died my last year of my using. My best friend hung himself. Several of the people that I was close to died. A lot of things happened that last year of my using that ended me up hating myself a little bit more every day. That stripped away my ability to rationalize and say it was okay. You know, there's one image that is kind of burned indelibly on my brain that I'll share with you. It's sitting backwards on a toilet like I did so often. Sick in the morning. Unable to get a vein. Dripping blood on the floor. Going, God damn, look what's become of me. Look at me. This isn't how it was supposed to be. What happened to that little kid who had dreams? And I hated myself, and I felt that compelling, devastating awareness of the reality of my life. And I never, ever want to forget that time. Look what's been. And you got one too. The circumstances are maybe different. You know, maybe it's waking up in a cell one more time, going, I was going to do so good. I had such great plans. Look what happened to me. Maybe it's trying to stay clean and finding yourself loaded one more time, going, I didn't mean to do it. Maybe it's waking up with a stranger. Maybe it's waking up with a friend that you didn't intend to go to bed with. I don't know which is worse. Maybe it's stealing from your grandmother. Maybe it's having a child taken away from you. Maybe it's losing a marriage. Maybe it's holding a using partner in your arms while they die of an overdose. Maybe it's. Huh? But you got one. You got a time like that that you don't like to think about. It hurts. It makes you feel hopeless. Don't ever forget that time. There have been times when I have stayed clean just so I never had to sit on that toilet again. Just so I never had to feel that way again. And I know that if I go back to living the way I was living, I will go back to living the way I was living in all its misery. Now, I believe very strongly in something called the principle of reciprocity, the law of retribution, cause and effect, karma, if you will. What goes around comes around. People who live in glass houses should not throw stones. Do unto others as you would have. That's a very common principle, you know. It's expressed in every major philosophy and religion. The principle of reciprocity. And what it boils down to is the way you live determines the way you live. And if I'm out there running crazy, if I'm out there ripping and running and living in the fast lane and raising hell, that's when all I'm getting. And I'm getting negativity, I'm getting the fast lane, I'm getting hell, I'm getting ripping and running, I'm getting fear and paranoia, I'm getting negativity if that's what I'm living. You know, and that was real scary when I came to that realization. You know, the good side of that is if I'm out living a positive life or trying to be the best Greg I can be, like the program teaches me to be, my life's going to be pretty good. If I live by spiritual principles, things work out spiritually. If I'm living by self-will, things work the way they work with self-will, which for me is not very good. You know, it's like I was talking to someone about how we are oftentimes reluctant to get a sponsor for, and we're looking for just the right sponsor, right? I gotta find just the right sponsor. Give me a break, gang. You know, how good a job did you do with your life? I mean, if the person you pick is a complete fool, what do you got to lose? They can't hardly screw up your life any worse than you already have. I mean, this is Narcotics Anonymous. You know, we didn't get here because things go good. We got here, it's go to hell and turn left, and there's NA, you know. Yeah. Sometimes people talk about sharing and they're all worried about, well, they'll know I'm not perfect. We know you're not perfect, you know. This is NA. We know people don't get here perfect. You know, I can tell a lot of things about you when you stand up and you say, my name is so-and-so and I'm an addict. It means you're a fuck-up. Yeah. It means you don't know how to live. It means you're self-destructive. You know, it means you lie and like sweets, you know. It's a 30-year United States federal project that was the outcome of it. Drug addicts lie and like candy. That's the conclusion they reached. You know. I know a lot of things about you. I know that chances are you did some compromising things to get your drugs, like we all did. I know that you're a felon. I know that sometimes I don't want to be in the same town with you or province or country, you know, let alone in the same room, because you're an addict, because you're just like me. I know about drug addicts. I didn't when I first came around. Like I said, I was scared to death of you. There are five relationships that I think are imperative right away, and I strongly suggest these. They have nothing to do with sex. We don't do that in very well. We do it, but we don't do it well. We are invariably drawn to absolutely the worst possible people. I am instantly attracted to that person where I can end up saying, see, I told you I was no good, no one can ever love me, because it confirms my low self-esteem. I am instantly drawn to sick relationships because I don't know how to love. I don't know how to love. Love and addiction are kind of mutually exclusive. It's kind of like obsession and love. They don't exist at the same time in the same place. I can be obsessed with someone, but that's not love. Obsession is a selfish thing. It's like enabling, right? The difference between helping somebody and enabling them is helping is about them and enabling is about me. It has nothing to do with them. It's a selfish act. It's a selfish act. And I knew nothing about love. Addiction is the antithesis of love. You know, we have a threefold disease, physical, mental, and spiritual, right? Physical, our literature says, you know, when our whole mind is, and thinking is centered in drugs in one form or another, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. You read that. We read that in all our meetings, right? Does that sound like there's time for another human being? You know, I had time for other human beings after I got loaded. And after I got loaded, my world was distorted enough so I didn't give a shit anyway. It ain't love. It's not love. Or the mental aspect of disease, this part of me that will get strung out on anything. Or the type of people who take wonderful things and make them self-destructive. I'll talk some more about that later. You know, when our whole life and thinking is centered in something or someone, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. Again, there's no room for anything else. That's obsession. When everything else disappears and one thing becomes predominant in my life and I can focus on that hard enough, if I can focus on it hard enough, everything else disappears. Isn't that the nature of your obsession? That's the way it is for me. And I love it because, you see, it's these feelings and the stuff that goes on inside that I'm so afraid of. You know, and the spiritual aspect of disease, lack of faith, lack of hope, lack of trust, inability to relate as others as equals, self-obsession. Again, there's no room for love in that. That's not love. Lack of faith, lack of hope, lack of trust, inability to relate to others as equals, obsession with self. Addiction is the antithesis of love. But recovery is all about relationships, and it's all about changing our relationships. The first five that I mentioned, and I'll go through one at a time. You know, I think it's imperative that we begin by having a relationship with ourselves. Kind of a different kind of relationship than we're used to. This one's called honesty. You know, we start out by the cash register honesty, right? Don't lie, cheat, or steal. And that's tough for a lot of us. That's really hard for a lot of us. But harder yet is that emotional honesty. Getting real with each other. Letting you know who I really am terrifies me. Because you see, I carry that addictive thing that says, if you ever knew what I was like way down deep inside, there'd be no way you could accept me. I carry that, and it impacts all of our relationships. And in getting honest, I have to let you in and let you know that I'm afraid of you. Let you know my secret. I got a secret, folks. I got a deep, dark secret that I never wanted anyone ever to know. Way down deep inside of Greg, there's this little kid. This little kid is scared, and he doesn't know how to live. And he's faking it at this thing called life. And worse than that, he's vulnerable. You can hurt him without even trying, because he's super sensitive. And he will interpret the most innocent of actions on your part as rejection. And he's real, real lonely, even when there are a lot of people around. That's my big secret, gang. That's what I never wanted you to find out. That you could hurt me, and that I get lonely, and that I'm afraid. And now that I've said it, you don't have to hide it anymore, because yours is the same big secret. I believe that is your secret too. All of us are afraid. All of us are lonely, and all of us are vulnerable way down deep inside. And part of the job of recovery is to let each other see that and get the bullshit out of the way. So that little kid down in there can have a friend. So the sex goes out of the way, and the age goes out of the way, and the race goes out of the way, and all those things that we use to separate ourselves from each other. We set them aside in NA. And we find some real honesty. And in another person, we find the second relationship that I think is critical, and that's called fellowship. Becoming part of. Really being part of this thing. If you're sitting out there and you don't feel like you're part of Narcotics Anonymous, chances are you're not. You know, you probably go to meetings occasionally. If you feel different, chances are it's because you're acting different. In order to feel like a part of Narcotics Anonymous, you've got to be a part of Narcotics Anonymous. And NA isn't something you do for an hour and a half in the evening and then turn your back and go back and live like a real person. Do what you want to do. And he's a way of life. This is not an exercise in futility. It is not an intellectual challenge. It's a way of living. It's a way to change. If you don't like the way your life has been going, change the way you live. Now, we have a suggestion on how you might go about doing that. Fellowship. Become part of. Hang out. Stick with the people who seem to be happy, seem to be doing positive things. Stop living on the edge. Stop pretending like you're a dope fiend still. You know, I carried that dream, you know, that fantasy that I could give up the drugs, lose all the consequences, and still act like a dope fiend. Absolute freedom, no responsibility. The drug addict dream. I wanted to be, you know, probably the best episode of that, I can remember one time fairly early on, you know, when someone offered me a joint. I had maybe 30 days clean. And I went into this 30-minute monologue about how I didn't do that anymore and how it really almost wrecked my life and why I couldn't do that. And you see, I wanted them to think that I was still cool, even though I didn't use. Huh? I wanted them, you know what cool is? Cool's very interesting. Cool's what happens to your body about 10 minutes after your heart stops beating. We start getting cool. And I worked hard at being cool. I wanted to be cool, but I didn't think of it in quite those terms. Yeah, right. And even clean, I wanted you to think I was okay. I wanted to hide that scared little kid. I wanted to hide that conservative lame that lives inside of me. You know, I didn't want you to know about that because I was afraid you'd reject me. Right? And I was desperate for your acceptance because I didn't like me. And I had to have some kind of external validation. And in order to survive, so I looked at it from you, and I never gave you a chance to know who I was, you see. Because if you knew who I was, then you might reject me. And I wouldn't give you a chance to do that. Of course, the downside was that when you said, Greg, I really care about you, or Greg, I love you, my head went, yeah, but if they really knew. I never believed you could accept me, because I was so terrified you'd reject me. What a vicious circle. Please love me. Don't get too close. No wonder I was screwed up. Huh? Yeah. Disqualifying myself from the thing I was most desperate for. Disqualifying myself from your acceptance and your love. And I had to become a part of, and I had to let go of that. And the only way I could do that was through pain. The third relationship I think is critical is among the folks you run into and among the folks you join with in fellowship. Find someone special and say those tough words, will you be my sponsor? I hate those words because they imply that I'm not perfect. They imply that I don't have my shit together and I can't handle it on my own. They kind of verify that line in the basic text that says our self-sufficiency was a lie. Huh? I want you to think, I got my shit together. Here it is. It's kind of like my first four step. I got my shit together and here it is. Yeah, no. Right. But anyway, three relationships so far. Honesty, fellowship, sponsorship. Like I told you, you know, don't worry about finding the perfect sponsor. There is no such thing, you know. There's nobody in my community who can sponsor me just right. There's nobody in any community that can sponsor any of us just right. Again, we'll disqualify ourselves from that. The fourth relationship that I think is critical is something called integrity. Ooh, big word. Integrity, strict adherence to a moral code. Live this way. What does it say? A way of life here? Something like that? Vision of hope? A way of life? Something like that. Right. Live this way. Strict adherence to a moral code. Follow these 12 steps. We also have some rules that you ought to be aware of. Oh, there are no musts. Used to say there are no musts in NA. Then people say there are X number of musts in the basic text. You know, we have a moral code around here that is sometimes unspoken and sometimes needs to be spoken. If you want to be a member in good standing of Narcotics Anonymous, you've got to quit using. Sorry, there is no way around that. Yeah, you can hang around and chippy around for a while, yeah, we'll pat you on the back when you come back. One of the things that saddens me the most is when I see our relapsers come back and we pat them on the back going, it's okay, it's okay. It ain't okay, suckers. Sorry. Narcotics Anonymous is about not relapsing. I hear people say, well, relapse is part of recovery. Bullshit. Relapse has nothing to do with recovery. It's the opposite of recovery. Relapse has to do with the disease of addiction. And it's a reality for some of us. If you're coming back, God bless you. I love you. Stay. Don't do that anymore. Don't violate yourself anymore. But don't ask me to co-sign it and say it's okay and you can keep doing it. You know, because it's going to get you. And when you go out, it hurts me. You see, because I bet my life on Narcotics Anonymous. I bet my life that we never ever have to use again against our will. I heard that at my first meeting. Somebody said, hey, Greg, you never have to use again against your will. And I went, all right. And that meant something to me. That stupid statement meant something to me. If that means something to you, you never ever have to use again against your will. There's very, very little question that you're an addict. Because only an addict uses against their will. And I used against my will. I used after I promised myself never again. I used after I promised myself and others that I was done. I used against my will. You got to stay clean around. We got to relatively behave ourselves in our meetings. You know, that includes you know, hitting on newcomers or what we lovingly call 13th stepping, which to me relates to doing something with cripples because we come in here emotional cripples. We come in here incapable of love and healthy relationships. And sometimes people who've been around here before take advantage of that. Men and women take advantage of that in their desperation, in our desperation. And that also has nothing to do with recovery. It has more to do with the disease of addiction. It has more to do with substitution for people who don't have the drugs, you know, and haven't found freedom through surrender to a loving God. We need to start treating each other with some respect. We need to start loving each other instead of using each other. We need to start giving each other the grace and the time to build a foundation for recovery, you know, before we start abusing each other. I don't know anybody in Narcotics Anonymous who hasn't physically or emotionally or spiritually abused another addict. So it's us. It ain't them. It's us. No one has perfect recovery. You know, and we all fall into those traps one way or another. And I think part of growing up for our fellowship is finding a way not to do those things to each other. And I'm heavy-handed about this. I really am. Feel heavy-handed about it, but I don't hear enough people talking about it. I don't hear about the tragedy. I don't hear from the podium about the tragedies I hear over the phone. Huh? Yeah. Let's stop doing that to each other. We got to behave ourselves in these meetings. We got to give other people the right, same right to recovery that we have. Those are all unwritten rules around here, but they're very, very real. We'll tolerate you for a long time, but sooner or later, if you want to be an NA member, you got to be an NA member. I don't know if that makes any sense or not. You know, they say the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. There are a whole lot of people out there who have a desire to stop using who've never heard of Narcotics Anonymous. Just because you have a desire to stop using does not mean you're an NA member. I define an NA member as an addict, first and foremost, with a desire to stop using who has chosen to recover in Narcotics Anonymous. It's your choice. The only way to be an NA member is to be an NA member. And to me, that has more than just being here. That's more than just being here. Some of our unwritten rules, a moral code, strict adherence to a moral code, integrity, something I didn't know much about. I was like the wind. I'd change my mind every minute. You couldn't count on me except to be an addict and be unpredictable. Huh? Yeah. I work in the institutions, and people say, don't you trust me? Of course I trust you. I trust you to be an addict and do the things that addicts do. You know, do I trust you with my car? No, I don't trust you with my car. I'm not crazy. or something like that. You know, the fifth relationship is the one that I really want to spend, and the fifth relationship is going to be in the rest of what I say tonight. You know, and that's called spirituality. It's about a relationship with our beliefs. It's about finding something greater than ourselves that we can trust enough to trust. That we can love enough to love. That we can believe in enough to have some faith. That maybe, just maybe, the future might be okay. That just maybe the failures of our past have not predestined our future. That just maybe there is hope enough for recovery. And that's where it starts, I guess. For me, my first concept of a higher power was coming in here, and I saw addicts. And from what you said, I could say, hey, you know what? They're kind of like me. They share some weird things, but they're like me. I understand the feelings. Whatever's keeping them clean, there must be something greater in any one of them. That's my higher power. So I began with looking at whatever was keeping you clean might keep me clean too. Five basic relationships: honesty, fellowship, sponsorship, integrity, and spirituality. With these five relationships, we got a chance. Without those five relationships, recovery is difficult. Without those five relationships, we're left with self-will and loneliness and fear. Tough things for any of us. Those are some of the reasons I used, because I couldn't stand to live with those things. With those relationships in place, I don't have to live that way. You know, I came to NA kind of like I see other people come. The first thing I did, well, let me tell you how I got here. After that episode, sitting on the toilet, I started looking for help, and I started calling those telephone numbers you hear on the radio at 3 a.m. If you've got a problem, why don't you call this number? I finally got a hold of some kind of referral line or help line. I think it was a suicide line. I really don't know what it was. And they said, are you eligible for Narcotics Anonymous? And I go, I don't know. What do you got to be? And they said, well, we don't know, but here's this phone number we just got. Why don't you call them? So I called. And there was a meeting then. That was a Monday night. I think, or Tuesday night, or somewhere around there. It's all pretty vague to me. Early in October of 1970. And, you know, there was a meeting that night. I guess it was a Tuesday night. There was a meeting that night in Hermosa Beach, which was about a 30, 40-mile drive in Los Angeles from where I was living. And I was very sick, and I wasn't going to make that meeting. There was another meeting closer to where I lived in Hollywood on Thursday night. And they said, well, we have a meeting on Hollywood on Thursday. Why don't you come? Do you have a car? You know, and I'm not quite sure to this day whether they were finding out whether I had transportation or whether they were finding out if I could give other people rides, because there weren't very many cars in Narcotics Anonymous. And one of the things that kept me clean early on was somebody told me never go to a meeting alone. Because if you pick somebody up, not only do you give them a ride, but you get three meetings, the one on the way there, the one while you're there, and on the way back. And I believed them. You know, I was the time when early in my recovery when I'd go for fried ice cream, and it worked. You see, the fried ice cream worked. It worked real good because I'm still here. Anyway, I went to that Friday. I promised him I'd go to this Thursday night meeting. You know, and it's bizarre. You know, I was a good promiser. I'd promise you anything. I was good at promising. You know, some of you were probably good at promising. Sure, yeah, I promise. You know, still a little weak on follow through usually, but the promises were just fine. I was good promiser. Promise. Catch me if you can. You know. But I promised him I'd go to that meeting, and I spent half the day Thursday getting ready. I went underneath the bed, and I got this box with a suit and a tie and a black suit. I bathed. That was something different. There'd been this acid trip, I don't know, sometime in the 60s. Never since then, water hurt, you know, kind of like. Didn't really hurt, but it didn't feel good either. You know, showers. But I did, though. I mean, I bathed to go to this meeting, and it was, like I said before, there were going to be drug addicts there, and I'd heard about drug addicts. And, oh, God, I was afraid of drug addicts, because I wasn't like you. I was just this 23-year-old kid, you know, who'd never really been in trouble, but hated himself every day. Couldn't stand being who he was. And there is no consequence in the world worse than self-hate, to my knowledge. See, because that's the point we all get to. Whether we get to that in a prison or a treatment center or wherever, it's still self-hate. And that's the one that kicks our ass. So when we can no longer continue living as the person we are living, who we are, doing what we're doing, that's the consequence. That's the greatest consequence. When it ain't okay to be a human being, when it ain't okay to be who we are. And we all come from there, regardless of what our story is. Anyway, I got all dressed up and I went to this meeting, and like I told you, the only thing I really remember, Lois was there, she remembers it better than I do. I spoke, I don't have any idea what I said, you know, kind of like saying, it was probably like, well, you know, I don't know, I really don't have a problem, but you know, maybe a little problem, but I'm not like you, you see. It's really not that bad yet, I can handle it. Probably something like that. But I heard enough at that meeting to take me to another meeting. And I do kind of know what people thought of me when I first came around. About half the fellowship thought I was a narc. Yeah, that's right. See, because I was young and I had some education. I'd gone to college and flunked out. I was the only NA member who was, you know, basically at a college. I mean, I flunked out my senior year. I almost had a college education. I was young. I was 23. I was young, one of the youngest people in NA at the time. I had a job. Most people around NA didn't have a job. I had a car. Most people around NA didn't have a car. I was married. Most people around NA had lost their families. You know, and people started putting two and two together and came up with the fact this person can't be one of us. You know. But I was. And see, I didn't help things along either because I was looking for the differences. I did what all good addicts do when they come around Narcotics Anonymous, whether they come in begging or whether they come in desperate. We all begin by trying to disqualify myself, ourselves. And I looked at the differences rather than the similarities. And I'd hear people talking about Folsom Prison. I'd go, whoa, I never did that. And I'd move back a row, right? Or people talk about, you know, a Tascadero State Hospital for the criminally insane. I went, oh, I didn't do that. People talked about quarter-sized holes in their head after the shock treatments. I go, whoa, I never did. You know, people talk about this. And I'd go, whoa, and I move myself right back to the back of the room. Going, whoo, man, these are weird people. I don't know if I can handle this. You don't understand. And I'm this good little kid. I just use drugs every day for 15 years. You know, yeah, I know. I shoot heroin half an ounce a day, but, you know, I'm really not an addict. I'm different, you know. Yeah. And then I came to that first meeting. I used twice after that. My first meeting was on a Thursday night. I used Sunday night behind a lack of sleep. I hadn't slept in a week. And I fixed and I slept. Got up the next morning. It was a Monday morning. It was a Sunday that I used. I got up Monday and I went to a meeting Monday night. And they'd embarrass you back then. There weren't a lot. It's kind of like here, sort of, I guess, except maybe even smaller. You know, it's not like you'd go to some obscure meeting down the road 50, 60 miles and sneak in and get a white key tag that no one knows about, you know, and then come back to your home group and they're saying, aren't you due to celebrate a birthday? And you go, oh, no, no, I had some problems a few months ago, but it's okay now. You've heard people do that, right? It wasn't like that. There were only about 200 NA members and only about 20 meetings in the world. You know, and everybody knew you. And when you went and fucked up, everybody knew. And they talked bad about you. They did things like that to give you matchbooks and go burn yourself out, sucker. You know, there was this one guy who used to stand up, and when people came back from a relapse, he'd shake his finger at him. Don't talk to me for a year, because you betrayed me. And if you went up to talk to him, he'd go, don't talk to me! And he'd scream at you. That's right. And embarrass you. Look at that. That lop can't even stay clean. He's a loser. Huh? And Jack would embarrass you. Right there in a meeting in front of everybody. Ooh. Yeah, it was still. It wasn't very nice. I mean, I'm real grateful we don't do that, but thank God somebody did. And I don't hear that as much, but you know, thank God that somebody said that when I came around, because I needed to hear that, because it made me not want to relapse, and it kept me clean once or twice. But anyway, I came back, and he shook his finger at me, and you know, he talked to me in the first year. He was more talk than that, because he loved other, you know, us a lot. But I came back, and I had a spiritual awakening. I found out I could come back, and it was great. And during that week, that Sunday, I started going back to meetings on Monday. I went to meetings, and you know, the next Saturday night, there was no meeting, because there was no NA meeting on Saturday night anywhere in the world. Which seems hard for me to, you know, it's bizarre when I say that, but, you know, in October of 1970, there was no Saturday night NA meeting anywhere in the world. There had been one, but it folded. And so I didn't go to a meeting Saturday night, and on Sunday I went to see a buddy of mine that I was used to use with, and I said, you know, I found this wonderful thing, Narcotics Anonymous. Why don't you come to one of these meetings? You can be free. And I was pretty good. And I even talked him into coming with me. So I took him to a meeting. And on the way home, he said, this is bullshit, man. I'm going to go use. And I went, you can't do that. Because if you do that, I'll have to go with you and you'll wreck my recovery. All 7 days of it. And I bought and we used my outfit. You know. And, you know, I went instantly back into withdrawal. I had trash fever like I'd never, ever had it before. I shook so hard I couldn't lay on the bed. And I have never, ever been so sick in my life. You know, I went instantly back in withdrawals. It was horrible. It was the worst. There are times when I stay clean just so I never had to go through that again either. You know, I think there's something very therapeutic about kicking a habit. And I don't know how sometimes we do it with treatment centers and methadone and things like that and all this stuff to prevent us from feeling the pain and the consequences of our addiction. I really sometimes wonder, you know, with as easy as it is to clean up these days, how come we stay clean? I mean, if it was this easy when I came around, I probably would have played it off and kept coming back. And kept coming back and kept coming back and kept coming back. And, you know, I would have become one of those boot and shoot hypes. Yeah. No shit. Because, you know, I had to feel that pain. For me, that's what was necessary for me to get to a point where I was willing to change. And that's what it takes for all of us. We have to get to a point where we're willing to change. The way you live determines the way you live. There is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude. It says that. We read that every night. This is an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. There is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude. How's your attitude? Scary question, huh? How's your attitude? An attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. That's a heavy statement. You know, I sometimes at conventions hear people, you know, when it says there's one thing, where they go, drugs! Yeah, but long before the drugs, there's the attitude. You can't be a dope fiend and a recovering addict at the same time. Sorry, you can't be a dope fiend and a recovering addict at the same time. Sorry. You can't live like an addict and expect not to live like an addict. You can't live like a dope fiend and expect not to live like a dope fiend. What does a dope fiend do? A dope fiend uses dope. If you're out there living like a dope fiend, chances are you're going to be living like a dope fiend. And part of our dilemma is that we can't kind of be a dope fiend or look like a dope fiend without acting like a dope fiend. We can't do it. Not for any length of time. Tough thing. And I learned that lesson. And what happened after that second time I used, that was October 25th, 1970, and that was the last time I used. What happened then was my attitude changed. And I moved from the back of the room going, I'm different. I'm not like that. Whoa, look at him. to the front of the room saying, "That's my chair and I'll fight you for it. And I don't care if you accept me, and I don't care if I fit in Narcotics Anonymous, because this is all I got. And you're going to have to chase me out of here if you're going to get rid of me. Because I am here for the long haul. This is the only chance I have at survival. And the heck with it's my attitude that's shitty. Life sucks. I used to say that. I lived my life based on the premise that life sucked. Life sucks, and then you die. Right? So I better burn brightly. Bullshit. Life doesn't suck. It doesn't have the capacity to suck. Life just is. It's the time between birth and death. You know, it's my attitude that sucks. Ain't it a bitch? No, it's not a bitch. It's my attitude that's a bitch. There is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude. If I come to an NA meeting or an NA function or a convention or, you know, looking for illness, I'll find it. If I come in, if I go back to the dorm tonight and I go looking around for all the people who are actively pursuing their disease, I'll have lots of justification never to return to Narcotics Anonymous. Because a lot of us actively pursue our disease. If I'm looking for dishonesty, I'll find it. But the other hand, if I'm looking for recovery, I can find that too. You know, I could go back to that same dorm and look for addicts practicing Narcotics Anonymous and practicing positive spiritual principles. And if I'm looking for it, I can find that too. If I'm going to a meeting going, "Man, these lops don't have anything for me. I've been clean 22 years. The next person in the room's at 9 years, and you know, I already know him. You know, I ain't going to hear nothing." If I go with that attitude, guess what? I won't hear shit. You know, but if I can come with the attitude that God works through people, even you, even though my head says no way, and I can look for the presence of the God that I've come to believe in what you say and what you do and who you are, then I will get everything I need and everything I ever wanted. It's my attitude. It's my attitude. It's in here. It's like there's nothing external about the first step. It's not the drugs. You know, when I came around, I could have sworn the first step said I admitted I was powerless over heroin and it had fucked up my life. That's what I thought it said. You know, I didn't know about this addiction stuff. I didn't know it was in here. You know, that's one of the things that makes Narcotics Anonymous unique, because ultimately we are saying that we admit that we are powerless over part of ourselves. That it ain't those things out there. It ain't the drugs. It ain't the people. It ain't the jobs. It ain't the geography. It's me. I am the problem. If I am not the problem, there is no solution. Narcotics Anonymous was unique in beginning with the premise that I am the problem, not some external thing. You know, and that's probably the one thing that sets us apart. I am the problem. It's me. And because it's me, you know, I can come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, not fix my addiction. Not fix my drug problem. NA is not a drug program. It's an addiction program. Some of the greatest growth I've had in the last couple of years has been in the second step. Today, when I think about the second step, what I think about is that I have believed and I am committed to the idea that this process, something power greater than myself, a spiritual process, can restore my relationship with God, can restore my spirituality, can restore my relationship with reality. So I don't have to live my life like fingernails on a blackboard. I'm sorry, I lived my life like fingernails on a blackboard for a long, long time. I don't have to live that way anymore. The promise of the second step is by engaging in this process, by coming to believe that a power greater than myself, that this process, that spiritual principles, can restore me to sanity, can restore me to reality, can restore me to spirituality. That frees me. And I can live in harmony with all things instead of at odds with all things. I can stop, as it said in our original literature, not only breaking the laws of man, but breaking the laws of nature as well. And that awareness has been reinstilled in me in the last couple of years because I started thinking about this thing called sanity. And you know, we say things and insanity is repeating the same mistakes and expecting different results. It says that in our basic text. I've come to believe that that's not true. Maybe that's a type of insanity, but what that is denial. Denying the experience of my past, repeating the same mistakes, expecting different results. Denying my experience is called denial. Maybe crazier than that is repeating the same mistakes, knowing what the results are going to be, and going ahead and doing it anyway. Yeah. And I do that too. I will consciously choose the self-destructive path. And that's a product of my disease and my insanity. I will consciously violate Greg one more time. Probably the most obvious example of that is with food. I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I weighed 180 pounds. 2 years later, I weighed 360 pounds. I gained a person. years after that, I was down to about 210, 220. I'd lost most of that. You know, maybe 130 pounds and felt pretty good. 5 years ago, I stopped smoking. Guess what? Yeah. You know, there was food all at once again. And I gained back all that weight and I started to lose it. And 3 years ago, I got ripped off. You know, for a bunch of money. And the money isn't what hurt. What hurt was I also got ripped off for a drink. In ripping me off with the startup money to form a retreat center for us, someone stole my dream. And one more time, I gave myself permission to eat, to medicate my feelings. Yeah. If it gets too bad, Greg, you can always eat. And I knew what was happening. That was not denial. I knew the price I would have to pay down the road. But the little bit of relief made me go ahead and do it anyway, even though I knew I'd hate myself in the morning. And that's insanity. That's insanity, much more than denial. Because in denial, I'm not aware. I used to kid around saying, sometimes I thought it was worse when I, you know, sometimes I think it's worse now that I know when I'm screwing myself than before I did. Huh? Yeah. Now I know, self-awareness. Kick my ass. It's kind of like the steps. Some of you are probably procrastinating on the steps. That's okay. If you don't want to work the steps, don't work them. You don't have to work the steps to stay clean. Just don't put nothing in your body, no matter what, even if your ass falls off. And if it does, pick it up, put it in a paper bag, and bring it to a meeting, and we'll take care of you. Don't use nothing, no matter what. Handy-dandy one-step program, any fool can work it. Right? Don't work the steps, as long as you can stand it. Yeah. You don't want to write an inventory? It's okay. Don't write an inventory. Ain't no skin off my nose. Keep making the same mistakes. Keep going through life with the blinders on. Keep picking sick relationships. Keep going after jobs that you end up hating. Don't find out what the rules are. We'll blunder through life a little longer. Huh? Go ahead. Don't write that inventory. Ain't no skin off my nose. If you stay clean, I will venture to say there will come a time when you will beg someone to teach you how to write an inventory. Please. Can I do it now? Because huh? It hurts. You know, it hurts without the recovery. It hurts without the growth. It hurts without finding a different way to live. It hurts. Keep on, keeping on. See how bad it hurts. As long as you can stand it. Oh, I got excuses for you. It's the wrong time to write an inventory. I'm in the wrong place to write an inventory. I don't have the right sponsor to write an inventory. I don't really, my third step isn't strong enough yet. It's not fearless. I'm not fearless. My third step today is to live life insecure in the knowledge that maybe God will take care of me. You know, and I got 22 years of experience. It says that every single time I have gotten the hell out of the way and let God take care of business, everything's turned out just fine. My initial reaction to difficulties in my life is still, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. This time it's going to be different. What can I do to fix this? And I know that's crazy. Because I have all this experience saying, God works, God works, God works, God works. Greg doesn't work. Never, never makes the right decisions. Left to your own devices, you'll destroy yourself. I mean, And still, my initial reaction to the trials and tribulations of living is disease. If you put enough stress on Greg, Greg will break out in addiction one way or another. So far, it hasn't been necessary for me to use. But my disease has been alive and well a lot of the time in the last 22 years. And I consciously violate myself. I consciously choose the self-destructive path. You know, my need to believe that a process can restore my spirituality and restore me to sanity is just as important today, maybe more important today than it was when I first came around. Because when I first came around, I had a lot of blind faith. And then, you know, I had the, duh, everything's great, it's going for me. You know, because I went through what we go through. You know, after I got done with that self, you know, deception, initially, the disqualification, after a period of time, I found myself getting high off of not getting high. And it felt good not to have to kiss the connections behind. And it felt good not to have to do the things I had to do to stay clean. It felt good not to have to sell my friends bad dope. It felt good not to have to live the way I was living. I got a little relief. Felt good not to have to be sick and tired of being sick and tired, like they say. Felt good. And not using was like a new drug. And wow, this is great. And then I memorized the little white booklet or the readings. And I had all the answers. And he asked me a question and I'd quote. You know, it's kind of like that. There's one thing more than anything else, the little fetus in my recovery. It's principles. I said it quickly so I didn't have to say it correctly. I said it quickly so you'd think I knew what I was talking about, but I had no idea. You know, three of these are in special, well, honest, open mind, willingness. I had the answers. I had all the answers. Turn it over. There ain't a whole lot of answers. They're all in the little white booklet. Heck, they're all in what we read every meeting. Here are all the answers. Here are all the answers. If you do this, you can change your life. Just do this. I had no idea what the questions were, and I didn't understand this. So I sought through trial and error, you know, to run my life. You know, and at 4 months clean, it was like the big bird of feelings flew over and went, oh my God, I remember these. Now what I do? And I ran around crazy for 2 months, and at 6 months clean, I'm going, oh my God, it's not the drugs. What do I do now? And the answer was called substitution. See, I'd figured out by that time, here I am, I was, you know, if I just stayed clean for a while, everything was going to be okay. You know, God, that's what I heard. At least that's what I wanted to hear. May not be what you said, but that's what I heard. If I just stayed clean, everything would be okay. Everything would be wonderful. Here I was, I hadn't used nothing in 6 months, and my life was still a mess. And I still hated myself, and I had all these feelings, and I didn't know what to do with them. So I quit, started running around looking for things outside myself to medicate my feelings. And the harder I could focus on something out there, you know, the less I have to worry about what was going on in here. There is nothing external about the first step. When I say I am powerless over my addiction, my life has become unmanageable. That's all in here. And I was looking out there for something to avoid dealing with what was in here. And I found people, places, and things. And I had food, sex, and working, and not working, and collections, and rocks, and gems, and minerals, and lapidary, and stamps, and coins, and bottles. Yeah, rocks. I got 3 or 4 ton of rock at home, and every once in a while I move it. I have a museum-quality mineral collection. And I also have tons of rock. that are best to be described as garden rock. And I learned how to cut and polish stones and do silver work. I made this. And it was great, and it kept me clean. And when I was angry, I could go out in the garage and grind my fingers to the bone on these wheels with these rocks. And, or take a torch and melt silver. And I had a way to deal with all that stuff I didn't have any way to deal with, and no surrender. And I learned to substitute real good. And, I went through what we go through. And, coming up on a year when you're going, oh, my God, if I stay clean 2 more weeks, then I might have to do this thing for real. Oh, shit. I won't be a newcomer anymore. I won't get any attention. Oh. Right after a year, when you're going, boy, I'm glad that's over. Now I can get back to living like a real person, I made it. I'm here. I'm arrived. I don't have to go to meetings anymore. I don't have to do this. That's okay. I can handle it. I got my shit together. I've stayed clean a year, man. Or the second half of the second year, we're going, oh, this is boring. This is so boring, man. I've heard this person share 42 times, and they always say the same damn thing, and it doesn't make any sense anyway. And and this person, and look at the people around here, they're all losers. And, after all, I've got important things to do now, like watch TV, play Nintendo, read books. I'm trying to educate myself. I've only got 1,800 science fiction paperbacks and have read most of them. I have about 1,800 science fiction paperbacks. That was another one of those substitutions, fantasy. Reading. It's all right to sit up all night and read a book. Normal people do that every once in a while. If you do it 2 and 3 and 4 nights in a row and you're falling asleep behind the wheel of your car on the way to work, that's a problem. That's not normal. Substitution. It started for me around 6 months, and the boring time around a year and a half, a little bit more than a year and a half. Because I quit doing the things that were fun in Narcotics Anonymous. I quit going out to coffee. I quit staying after the meet and talking to you. I quit going over to your house. I quit asking you over to my house. And it seemed like it was boring again. Recovery's not fun anymore. No, man. Recovery was fun. I just wasn't any fun. It's so boring. It wasn't boring. I was boring. People who are bored are usually very boring people. They sit on their dead ass and they don't do nothing but feel sorry for themselves. That's who I was. At 2.5 years, I went through a thing going, I knew I was sick, but I had no idea. Because you see, all that substitution kind of quit working. And that was scary. I see a lot of relapses around 2.5 years. A lot of times when the substitution quits working, we don't have any better ideas. And if we've slipped away from our meetings, if we've let that substitution get in the way of the things we needed to stay clean on a daily basis, when it quits working, we ain't got nothing left. Because we've alienated ourselves from the fellowship. Our priorities are all screwed up. I believe every relapse can be related to misplaced priorities. Something has become more important than staying clean. And we find ourselves going, oh, how'd I get here? At 5 years, it seemed like the program quit working. It was a very scary time for me. I have buried friends who blew their brains out at 5 years clean. Terrifying, because for me it seemed like the program quit working. I did what I was told, man. I'd go to a meeting and talk about my feelings, and I ended up leaving feeling worse than when I got there. And I'd share, and I'd go, why do I even bother? I don't even believe this shit anymore. I'd work with newcomers. I'd go pick someone up and talk good shit to them, take them to a meeting, and take them home and drop them off. And on the way home, I'd go, why do I even bother? They got more going for them than I have for me. At least they have hope. I'd call my sponsor, and my sponsor suggested that I do something, and I'd end the conversation feeling worse than when I called him. I'd write, and it would just bring out the pain. Yeah, and I had to come to a point, and this is one of those vulgar things, where I was back off in the corner, going, this God shit that everybody's talking about, it better be for real or I'm fucked. Because that's how I felt. This thing called spirituality that all of you talk about, that I kind of half-ass never really believed you really did, had better be for real, because I don't have any more good ways and good ideas about how to fix Greg. And I've learned that I can't fix myself even with NA, and I got nothing left. I had to turn my recovery over to the care of a power greater than myself. I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity and begin to work a third step, begin to live life based on the possibility that maybe there was a loving God that would take care of me. And that's still, in essence, my third step. To live life, like I said before, insecure in the knowledge that there is a loving God that will care for me. Around 7 years, 8 years, I believed enough where I was willing to take a risk, where I was willing to trust my life to that fledgling spiritual relationship. You know, I said my definition of the second step has changed. I went down the same path most of us go through. You know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves, power greater, that must be that higher power thing I keep hearing about. Yeah, come to believe that higher power can restore us to higher power. Isn't that God? Okay, come to believe that God can restore us to sin. And I'm not really crazy, so the most craziest thing I did all has to do with my drug use. So come to believe that God can fix my drug addiction. And that's not what the second step says. But that's the path I went down mentally. Eventually I had to write an inventory again. The first few inventories I wrote, the first two or three inventories I wrote, I do not believe were fourth steps. I think they were written first steps. They had to do with an assessment of the unmanageability of my life. They were more about show and tell than about morality. The fourth step says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, an assessment of our morality, our belief system, what we think is right and wrong, how we can live this life using spiritual principles, what we want in a partner, what we want in a career, what our personal rules for living are about. And we all got them. I'll give you an example. I mean, I work, and it's okay for me to put a pen in my pocket and go home from work. That's within my morality. It ain't okay to take a typewriter home. They're both writing implements, and they both belong to someone else. And in the strictest sense, you can interpret both as stealing. What's the difference? The difference is my morality. It's okay for me to go away to a convention, you know, and sit at the dinner table with another woman besides my wife and enjoy her company. It's not okay for me to take her to bed. What's the difference? The difference is my morality. And I got to live with my morality. One of my big problems is I went through life and I didn't know what my morals were. And I was living an active addiction which caused me to violate all of them regularly. And no wonder I hated myself. Part of recovery is finding out what my morals are, assessing my morality, taking a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, so I don't have to keep doing that shit to myself. So I don't have to keep going for what I don't want. So I don't have to keep violating myself. My greatest pain comes from when I violate my own morals. That kicks my ass. And when I go against what I believe. And I didn't know what I believed, so I had to find out. Some of the rest of the change that has come along recently has been a reorientation for me, or maybe not a reorientation, but at least an addition to the way I look at the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th steps. Today I believe my defects are those things that separate me from God. Things that get in the way of God of this process restoring my spirituality. Things that get in the way of spiritual growth. I believe the 12 steps are just as sure a path to enlightenment as any other path that exists, if done thoroughly for a long enough period of time. I don't know anyone who's close. I've never met anyone who's close, I don't think. Well, I may have met one or two people who are close, but I've never met an addict who is close. You know, so I don't have to worry about that shit. But I believe this spiritual path is just as true a path to God as anybody's got. And that by living this way, I can get closer to God. My defects are the things that prevent that, that separate the things that separate me from God. And my shortcomings are the way those things show up in day-to-day living. And that's a dilemma. See, there are three things that I have to ask God for in the process of the steps. There are three petitions that I make. I think. The third step, I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. You know, I'm petitioning God to take care of me with that decision. I'm asking God to take care of me when I make that decision and that commitment. In the seventh step, I humbly ask Him to remove my shortcomings. I ask for growth and change and the removal of the things that stand between me and spiritual growth. And in the 11th step, I ask for knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out. Knowledge and power, which translate into direction. Take care of me. Restore me. Give me direction. Those are the three things that I ask of this God we come to believe in the process of the steps. God's answer to those things is very, very simple. One of the things I've come to believe is that God is not complicated. God's will is not complicated. It is the simplest thing in the world. If I got to figure it out, I missed the point. God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free, to live life abundantly, and to follow a spiritual path. That's it. Is it God's will for me to have this job? God probably doesn't care. As long as you live life abundantly, be the best person you can be, and follow a spiritual path. Should I get involved in this relationship? Hey, God, is this right? God doesn't care. God wants you to be happy. Live life abundantly. Be happy, joyous, and free. Follow a spiritual path. You know, we're the ones who worry about all that stuff. You know, it's kind of like, you know, being an addict. You know, we just made a big deal of a clean time countdown, right? And I got 22 years clean. I've been married for 23 years. That's probably more of a miracle. My wife is not an addict. It's probably been longer since she's used a drug than anyone else in this room. You know what? Ain't a big deal for her. She doesn't care. She's not an addict. It's a big deal for me, huh? Remember getting that 30 days clean and what a big deal it was? Man, medallion, key fob, chip. Wow. I don't know what the system you use. Fob's here, I guess. And it was such a big deal, remember that? And 60 days was a big deal. Do you think a non-addict would be thrilled about not having anything for 30 days? They probably wouldn't care, would they? So? Never was that important to me anyway. It was that important to me. You know, I qualify. Anyway, I digressed a little bit. I believe that God's answer to those petitions is very simple, just like my higher power is. God's answer is, no sweat, I got you covered. Here's what I want you to do. When I ask God to take care of me, God says, no sweat, here's what I want you to do. Take a searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself. Trust, I'll take care of you. Trust me. I'll take care of you. Don't worry about it. I got you covered. And then share it with another human being. And me. Huh? Don't have to worry about it. Trust me. And I humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings. God says, I got you covered. Don't worry about it. Trust me. Here's what I want you to do. We're going to take care of all that shit for you. All those things that separate you from me. First of all, we're going to take all that shit out of your past. Here's what I want you to make a list of the people you've harmed. Become willing to make amends to them all. And make direct amends to them whenever you can. Except when except you can't. It's a self-help program. You can't hurt others in the process of trying to help yourself. That's not spiritual. Except when to do so would injure them or others. And that'll take care of all that shit you carry around from the past. And you don't have to hate yourself because of what you did in the past. And all that stuff won't get in the way of our relationship anymore. And if you can do that, then you don't have to worry about that stuff anymore. And I got a plan for your present, too. It's called the 10th step. It's called self-awareness. Take a personal inventory of yourself. And when you're wrong, promptly admit it. Try and find some balance in your life. The result of a 10th step is balance. You know, part of my problem is I saw balance like a picture in perfect symmetry. A place for everything and everything in its place. Have you ever tried to balance a broom on your hand? Do you stay still and have it work? No, it's constant movement, isn't it? Or think of the guy on the high wire with the bar. It's constant movement. It's constant adjustment to what life gives him. It's balance. Balance is constant awareness of self, constant awareness of principle, constant adjustment to life. Keeping things in perspective. It's not a static thing. I wanted a picture with everything in its place. I was disappointed. It took me 15 years to learn that lesson. Maybe I'm still learning. I probably haven't learned it yet. Balance is continual adjustment. By working the 10th step, I can stay in balance. It gives me the tools with which to adjust. I don't have to pick up any new garbage between me and my higher power in the process of living. With a 10th step, God's got me covered for the present. And with an 11th step, God's got me covered for the future. knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out. If I can live my life, if I can get closer to my higher power through prayer and meditation, through life, the greatest prayer someone can offer to a God of any kind is the way they live. My sponsor taught me, one of my sponsors taught me that. And it was a gift I could not appreciate for years and years and years, because I believe that life is prayer and meditation. That my behaviors are a form of prayer. And that scared the shit out of me when I thought about some of the ways I was behaving. And that my consciousness is a form of meditation. If I can be aware of the presence of God in all things, then I can hear God in all places. And God becomes a part of a conscious thing. You know, if I can do that well enough, I can be free. You know, and if I can look to God's will for me, spiritual direction, rather than what I want, rather than my desires and my self-will, and the way I think it should be, if I can go with spiritual direction, if I can go with God's will for me, and if I can tap into spiritual power rather than personal power, self-will, then I don't have to worry about my future either. God's got it covered. And I will have the promise that begins the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. The fulfillment of the promise of the second step. This process can restore my spirituality, my relationship with God. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Those fit together for me today. The 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th steps are fulfillment. The 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th steps are the fulfillment of the 6th and 7th step. That's how God removes my shortcomings. By giving me a tool to eliminate them in my past, present, and my future. And the 12th step becomes the description of recovery. Living a life based on an awakening of the Spirit. On spiritual principles, not selfishness, not disease. I try to carry this message to addicts. Don't tell me how good you're doing. Show me by the way you live. I am the message and you are the message. Our lives are the message of Narcotics Anonymous. And practice these principles in all our affairs. Expand the circle. Take it in. Fulfill this destiny. And we can have something beyond our wildest dreams. Man, you know, to me, I am humbled and blown away by the reality that today my life means something. And all I've had to do is live this way. And people have given up their lives to have them mean something. And it's given to me. Here, Greg. It's yours, and I don't deserve it. Or maybe I do, but I never believed I deserved it. God says it's okay to love yourself, and today, you know what? It's okay for me to be gray. It's okay to be 46 years old. I had all my teeth pulled 2 weeks ago. I got parts on order. Yeah. Gray. Fat. Poor. It's all okay. It's all that outside shit. Man, way down deep in here, it's okay to be Greg. Greg's okay. And Greg never, ever was okay. And it was never, ever okay to be me. Today it is. And I found out that I can make a difference. Through service, I can make a difference. By giving to you, by living this way, I can touch your life just as surely as you can touch mine. And in touching each other's lives, we give meaning to our time here on earth. Some of you have had an impact on my life. And I've had an impact on some of your lives. To me, that's the magic of NA. That's the miracle of NA. That's the awe-inspiring, overwhelming reality of Narcotics Anonymous, is that by living this way, we fulfill our wildest dreams. We learn to love ourselves, to to like ourselves more importantly, and we give meaning to each other's lives. If you want it, come fucking get it. Thank you.